Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And we have a deep thinking show for you today.
That's right. In Culture Talk, Sandra will be interviewing visiting scholar and philosopher Mark Perez on evolution and fallacies.
You know, speaking of evolution, Jess Wernick will be talking with biochemist Fuzzle Rana and diving even deeper into evolution and how it relates to his newest book.
Yeah, it's going to be some great topics. But first up is RTB 101. Krista will be talking with astronomer Hugh Ross about how you can help devout Jews consider Jesus.
Let's check it out.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about a very provocative question, how can we help our devout Jewish friends consider Jesus as the Messiah, is my colleague, Dr. Hugh Ross. Welcome, Hugh.
Well, thank you for making me part of this.
Let's maybe start with some definitions, because what we're going to talk about today is the source of it was a blog post that you wrote, and you used the term devout Jew. So maybe let's start there, is when we're talking to our Jewish friends, maybe we should have some understanding that there's different kinds of Jews and what constitutes what you're thinking about as a devout Jew.
Yeah, I define a devout Jew as a Jew who takes the Tanakh seriously. The Tanakh is a Jewish term for the Old Testament. So I want to see if they're actually reading these Old Testament scriptures, and if they take them as the word of God. If they do, then I know I'm dealing with a devout Jew.
Very good. So when we talk to our Jewish friends, that's kind of a first point of conversation, is to try to assess what their view of scripture is, of the Tanakh.
Correct.
Okay. Now, let's move into maybe a little bit of understanding about some of the most common obstacles that you've run into over the years in your conversations with devout Jews. What are some of the key issues that often hinder them from considering Jesus as the Messiah?
Well, I've been engaging Jews in Vancouver, Toronto, here in the LA area, and over in Europe, and it seems no matter where you go, how the same barriers come up. The first one is they say, well, your Jesus didn't fulfill all the Old Testament prophecies, and therefore he can't be the Messiah. The second one is they say, you know, you believe in a Trinity. We believe that God is one. So that's a barrier for them. Another one is their doctrine of good works. They think good works is a pathway to salvation. And then probably the fourth big issue is the Holocaust. They look at the Holocaust as something that's really a black mark against the Christian faith. Christians living outside of Nazi Germany really weren't that aggressive in taking in Jews that were trying to escape the Holocaust. And so they blame not only the Christians that were there in Germany, but those in Russia, those in America, Britain. And so they basically said, the body of Christ let us down.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, now maybe walk us through some of your strategies of how you respond to these things. So when we're talking to our Jewish friends who do take the Bible seriously, or as you called it, the Tanakh, which is the Jewish scriptures, is there any place to begin the conversation that's better than another place?
Well, I found that usually the fulfilled prophecy concerning the Messiah is important, because that's their big issue. They reject Jesus because he didn't fulfill all the prophecies. And just to begin a conversation saying, well, if they're a devout Jew, they typically believe that Elijah comes at two different times over a span of thousands of years. I mean, they even set a chair for Elijah when they celebrate the Passover on the anticipation that he will have a second coming. Well, if Elijah can have two comings, why can't the Messiah have two comings? I've also discovered most devout Jews think that Jesus fulfilled maybe a single handful of prophecies in the Tanakh. And so just saying, well, let's look at the prophecies he did fulfill. We know he didn't fulfill all of them, but let's look at those he did fulfill. And I find that many of them are stunned to discover there's over 100 specific prophecies in the Tanakh that Jesus fulfilled to the letter, and just ask him, you know, what's the probability of that happening without divine intervention? And actually have him go through those passages, because as they go through them, they'll recognize that these prophecies are really referring to the Messiah coming to suffer and to die and to pay the atonement price. Whereas most devout Jews are looking at the Old Testament, the Tanakh prophecies about him coming as a conquering king. And that will happen in his second coming, but his first coming had a very different purpose. And I found that especially going through Psalm 22 is helpful, because that psalm basically details all the events that would happen when the Messiah would be dying on a cross. It was a prophecy written by King David and written centuries before crucifixion was even invented as a means of execution. And yet when you read it, the detail is all there, including even the words of mockery that would be thrown at him. And then going through Daniel 9. Daniel 9 is where you see the explicit prophecies about the Messiah coming at two separate times. And again, most devout Jews I've encountered really haven't taken the time to go through the book of Daniel. We need to recognize most devout Jews have a very high and thorough understanding of the five books of Moses, the Torah, and the Psalms, but often that's their limit of knowledge of what the Tanakh really has to communicate.
Well, that's helpful, because I like your example of Elijah having two comings, so you can kind of lead them into a space of maybe some of these prophecies about Jesus have been fulfilled, but then there's other prophecies that we're awaiting to be fulfilled when he comes back, that he will be that conquering king that they were looking for. I think that's a really helpful strategy. Maybe you can give us one other tip of a key response that Christians can engage with their Jewish friends about.
Well, the Trinity is a huge barrier to devout Jews, and they think that we Christians get that doctrine from the New Testament. I find that it's a shock for them to discover that the most explicit and extensive biblical statements on the doctrine of the Trinity are in the Tanakh, not the New Testament, particularly the book of Isaiah. And again, it's my experience that most devout Jews really haven't paid much attention to the book of Isaiah. Matter of fact, certain chapters in the book of Isaiah are basically on the forbidden list. They're communicated that these are such challenging passages that only when you get to Jewish seminary can you get the understanding of what they have to say. But I also like to say, well, aren't you at least curious about what Isaiah the prophet's got to say? And actually taking it through, especially chapters 40 through 53, and just going through those texts and realizing repeatedly it says, Yahweh is one and only one. There's only one creator. But then you see that three distinct persons take the title of Yahweh, and just actually showing them that that's in their Tanakh, their Old Testament. It's not something that comes from our New Testament. I've seen lots of Jews become Christians simply by reading those texts in the Old Testament that the rabbis told them not to read because they were too difficult. So just simply arousing their curiosity about these texts and saying, wouldn't you like to at least see what they got to say?
Well, that's good. And I want to direct our viewers to go check out your blog post. They can go to our website at reasons.org and search for Today's New Reason to Believe. And they can see your whole blog post with all of your strategies for engaging our devout Jewish friends. Thank you so much, Hugh.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Now it's time for Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm Sandra Dimas, and I'm joined today with Mark Perez. Thank you for joining us today, Mark.
Good to be here.
So you are a longtime member of the Reasons to Believe Apologist community, and you've been a member of our local visiting scholar program, and you're focusing on philosophy of science. And I'm glad that you're here today because you have written a chapter that's going to be in Thinking About Evolution, which is RTB Press's latest book. And you're writing about fallacies, which is such an important topic as we delve into something like evolution. So thank you again for joining us. You ready to get started?
I think so.
All right. So in Thinking About Evolution, you have a chapter on fallacies and how they relate to discussions about evolution. And you discuss a handful of fallacies, which I think is really helpful to kind of name what they are and then show what they look like. But today we're going to focus on just two. So we have the equivocation fallacy and the irrelevant conclusion fallacy. First, let's dive into the equivocation fallacy. Can you explain what that is?
Equivocation fallacy is when you use a particular term that has multiple meanings as if it only has one. Or you use it at a time when because of the vagueness, you can play off of that vagueness and be vague in what you're alleging or asserting. And that causes a lot of problems.
So that an example of that would then be saying, hey, Mark, do you believe in evolution? And we're using the term evolution to mean all things. And we can't quite answer that in a very clear way. Is that one example?
Sure. What happens is you start talking past each other. Because, for example, in the term evolution is a really good term because it is equivocated so often. There are at least three definitions that you can think of for evolution. So one of them is just change through time. Okay, that's an evolution. The other one is something called macroevolution. And we're talking about biological evolution. Macroevolution is, for example, the Darwinian theory where all of us are descended from a last universal common ancestor, for example. And there's microevolution, where you have changes in populations, genetics changes in the populations within the species, and it's limited to that. So for an example of that might be bacteria that mutate and become resistant to drugs. So you have those three different kinds of definitions of evolution. And one of the things that happens in popular media and particularly in cultural discussions is that someone will make a really wild claim and say, well, evolution is a fact. Mm-hmm. But what do you mean by that? As soon as they say that, without specifying which one of those three definitions they're talking about, they have just equivocated. And then when somebody disputes what they're saying, who knows what they're disputing?
Right. And I think that's important because that is a challenge that people will bring up to Christians and say, well, you don't believe in evolution. And some might just say, well, yeah, you're right. I don't believe in evolution. And some might say, let's define what we mean. And I think exactly. That's very, very helpful because then you're agreeing to something that hasn't been defined. And so you're no longer on common ground when you're talking about this term. I think that definitely does come up. I've been asked that question. I don't know if you've been asked that question, but I have. Do you believe in evolution? And I was nervous, but I think now I'm much more equipped to answer that question and say, well, let's talk about the different types of evolution, the types that we have evidence for and the types that are still somewhat unsettled, and then go from there.
Sure. I mean, you have those three that are very easy. A Christian, for example, could easily say, yeah, I agree with microevolution. It's obvious that bacteria mutate and become resistant to drugs. And I believe that that change through time counts for evolution. I mean, we see that in the fossil record. But what I don't believe is the evolution that says that we all are descended from some last universal common ancestor. Let's talk about that.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great distinction. So now let's move on to the other fallacy that you discuss in this chapter, and that's the irrelevant conclusion fallacy. So let's define what that is first.
The irrelevant conclusion fallacy is the mistaken reasoning in which you shift the conclusion. In other words, if somebody posits a particular conclusion, you try to answer it or you pretend you're answering it, and actually you come up with a different conclusion that's irrelevant to the first one. For example, you have about 560 million years ago, plus or minus, you have something called the Cambrian explosion. And the Cambrian explosion is a sudden burst of body plans that occurred in creatures all over the world. So you have nothing but sponges and algae before that, and then all of a sudden, boom, you have creatures with backbones, with brains, with lungs, with gills, with feet, with different kinds of body plans, all at the same time and very quickly, at least geologically quickly. If I'm going to argue that they're using a computer program can model that kind of diversity. For example, let's say I have a computer scientist, and it's actually happened, by the way, where computer scientists have said, I have a computer algorithm that I can generate these kinds of diversities very quickly. And if I put in the right algorithm, it proves it. Well, that's an irrelevant conclusion, because the question at bar is not whether you can come up with a computer program or an algorithm that's clever, but can you give us the biochemical evidence that this occurred naturally rather than by some kind of divine input? And so the irrelevant conclusion that they're providing is this computer program or these algorithms, when they're really irrelevant.
Right. And so can you give maybe another example of where we might see this fallacy come up when we're talking about evolution, particularly as we talk about from an older creationist perspective? Because I think you make an example there, and you're referring to using the term creationism and how that is used by those who embrace evolution, macroevolution, and how they're kind of knocking down creationism and not defining it in the same way as nuanced as it should be.
Yeah, I would say that that's more of an application of equivocation. Mm-hmm. Because what they're doing is they're making a claim, or it's better than that, it's actually a straw man argument. Because what they're doing is they're saying that if you believe in creation theory, then you must believe in young earth creation theory. Right. So they beat up young earth creation theory and then claim that they beat up old earth creation theory. And so in that respect, the fallacy is a straw man argument. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult to see if you're not paying really close attention, because the language can shift very subtly. But when you check for that kind of subtle change in language, you can identify it quickly.
In that sense, you know, we go back to the importance of what you talk about, defining those terms and making sure we're kind of coming from the same place first, and then we can have that conversation.
Yes. Without that kind of clarity, you're talking past each other or worse.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that, Mark. So if you want to check out this important book, Thinking About Evolution, 25 Questions That Christians Want Answered, go to reasons.org/2819. And in the months of October through December 2020, you can get this book in exchange for a donation in any amount.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here, and welcome to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas to help you be more confident in the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Dr. Fuzz Rana, and we're going to discuss, what do we do with evolution? Fuzz, it's good to have you here today.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
So this is one of those topics that just seems to be kind of a, if all honesty, kind of a big boogeyman in the church. You know, when you talk about evolution, hairs on the back of the neck get raised, anxiety goes up. What do we do with evolution? Because it seems like it's a very popular scientific idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be clear, evolution is the prevailing scientific view to account for the origin of life and then for the history and the design of life. And for many Christians, they see evolution as being deeply problematic. And part of the reason is because the scientific community is attributing the capacity to create to the evolutionary process. That is, mechanism can create. We don't need a mind. We don't need a creator. And so for many people, they look at the evolutionary process and they say, well, if evolution can explain everything, then why do I need a creator? And so evolution keeps many skeptics away from the Christian faith and creates trouble and problems for people who hold to a Christian worldview.
So evolution doesn't have just this singular univocal meaning that there's actually, it's almost like when we're talking about evolution, we need to understand what type of evolution we're talking about to really engage it.
Yeah, and to be fair, evolution does mean change in biological systems over time. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what type of change are you talking about? So for example, one form of evolution is microevolution. This would be variation taking place within a species. And so the classic textbook example would be the peppered moth changing wing colors from white to dark and dark to white in response to changes in environmental pollution. Another type of evolution would be what we might call speciation, where this is one species transforming into another closely related species. The Galapagos finches is the textbook example for that type of evolutionary change. So
the distinction in those is that the microevolution is a species just kind of changing the way it looks, but nonetheless, it's still the same species, whereas speciation is that change becomes significant enough that now no longer you have two separate species.
Right. And in a sense, it's the microevolutionary mechanisms that are operating over significant enough periods of time and with some geographical isolation of that population into separate groups that take those microevolutionary changes down different trajectories that lead to the formation of a new species. Another type of evolution would be microbial evolution, where single-celled microorganisms like bacteria can evolve, for example, resistance to antibiotics. These three types of evolution are all well-evidenced, they're well-established, and I don't see them as being fundamentally problematic to the Christian faith because they're not necessarily attributing creative potential to evolutionary processes. Those processes simply have the ability to fine-tune pre-existing designs. The next two categories.
In fact, it even seems like those are aspects of a well-designed system, that you've got creatures that can adapt to the environment rather than if the environment changes, they just go extinct. So it seems almost like those are designed well.
Yes, I would actually agree with that. That's a really, really good point on your part, that you could see these as actually part of the design, part of God's providential care for his creation. Now, the next two types of evolution are, to me, problematic, not only for the Christian worldview, but problematic from a scientific perspective. One would be chemical evolution or abiogenesis, or the origin of life, where chemicals self-assemble into the very first cells. And there's ample scientific challenges to this idea. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how scientifically this process could have occurred through chemical evolution, but it also is ascribing creative potential to the evolutionary process. And so where we see a theological concern is also where we see scientific issues with that particular idea. The next type of evolution, the final category, would be macroevolution, where one major group transforms into another major group. And here there are some very real concerns about the capacity of evolutionary mechanisms to actually generate biological innovation. This is an outstanding question in the scientific community, is how could these mechanisms of microevolution and speciation account for biological innovation and the creation of biological novelty? So again, this is where you might feel threatened from a Christian perspective about that facet of the evolutionary paradigm, but that's where there's some very real and significant scientific challenges to that particular type of transformation.
You know, I find your discussion very interesting there, that there are kind of these five categories, which are, you know, three of them are kind of a life adapting within some measure of what's there. And then you've got these two other categories. One is non-living things being transformed into living things. And the other is major categories of life being transformed into other major categories of life. What strikes me as interesting there, and I'd be interested to know your comment on this, is that it seems like those first three that you introduced seem to fit very well with the creator, and that's where there's a lot of evidence. The two that seem to be more problematic from a theological perspective are also the ones that seem to have trouble from a scientific perspective.
Yes, that's you know, well said. I would agree with that, and that to me is really encouraging. And what it also says is that as a Christian, we can at least embrace facets of the evolutionary paradigm and don't have to adopt what many people would consider to be an anti-scientific stance when it comes to evolution, but rather we can adopt a stance that is, in fact, thoroughly scientific, where the places where we're identifying shortcomings in the evolutionary framework are the very places where experts that are working in these areas are also likewise recognizing the shortcomings, at least the way in which the current evolutionary framework is conceived today. So in other words, we don't have to be threatened by evolution. We can clearly see a creator's involvement in the origin and the history and the design of life through both mechanism as well as through his intervention.
So last kind of quick question here as we're wrapping up. As you've engaged skeptics and Christians with this kind of division of how we think about evolution, have you found success in that people are amenable to look at it that way and see that there is support for the Christian worldview, if you will?
Yeah, well, for many Christians, this particular idea of five different categories of evolutionary transformations is extremely helpful in my experience. I've had less success engaging skeptics, in part because there is this idea that's entrenched within the mindset of many skeptics, and that is that the microevolutionary mechanisms could fully account for even large-scale biological change. Yet when you look at the work done by people that are experts in trying to understand those transitions in life's history, particularly from a mechanistic standpoint, most of the people working in those areas would readily agree that the theory as it's currently conceived falls short. And you're hearing people talk about the new synthesis, right, where there needs to be an extended evolutionary synthesis. And what that's saying is that we feel that the evolutionary paradigm is incomplete because it can't explain these very important transitions.
Well, thank you, Fuzz. I really appreciate your comments. You know, when it comes to talking about evolution, the short answer is definitions are incredibly important. And so it's important to really understand what those definitions are. You know, Fuzz and some of his colleagues have written a great book that addresses this and many other topics. I would encourage you to go to reasons.org/2819 to get your copy of his book today to be equipped to go out and share the gospel.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And we hope you'll subscribe to the show on YouTube, and you'll also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show, and we'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment, some likes.
And if you are watching on YouTube and maybe you like the audio version of the show, you can get us on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.